This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Hello everybody, this is Clint Locklear from Trapping Across America. And we've got it's going to be a really fast-paced show tonight, so sit back and just kind of enjoy it. Now, there's two emails, guys, that I've got that I'm holding. And I'm not going to have a show next week, but if you're out there listening, which I know you are, and you wanted to do a show next week for everybody, brother, you're on. If not, that's okay. I'll just blame you for not having a show. I think that seems fair. But I'm going to be gone next weekend. I'm preloading this one early. We're almost done with all our shows and stuff like that, so that ought to calm down pretty good. And but I'm going to be answering a lot of questions tonight on the radio show. So, and they're very interesting questions. Some of these I've really got to think about, guys. So, if I don't mind getting these. I can't answer all the emails. I wish I could. Please don't try to contact me on a private message on Facebook. It doesn't work. So, don't do that. So, if you need to contact when we have a question you want to hear on Trapping Radio, it's Clint@WolferNation.com. Clint@WolferNation.com. Now, before we get into the show, I want to talk about something I think would probably have some really cool applications to a trapper. Now, it's an app. It does cost, I think, $7 a month or $7 a year, something like that. You'd have to check on that. But it's called OnX Hunt, and you can go to the Play Store inside of a Droid. Now, I'm sure they have one for Apple. But what makes this really cool to a trapper is you can be driving down the road and you can see a property. And you can turn on this app and you'll see the property lines of the property, who owns the property, if there's any water, creeks, road systems, fields, whatever it is you're looking for, you can see all of that on this app. Now, I'm pretty sure there's probably other stuff out there that does very similar things, but to me, this is very handy. On the property we got, I was curious about where the property ended on the beach. It has the property lines of the property that I bought in there. I walked down to the corner, it'll put me right on the property. I'm looking around. Eventually, I found the old peg where the property line was, so it was right on. It's not totally free. There could be some free ones out there. I don't know. But this was one that I downloaded because a friend of mine said that's actually what his surveyor was using to help find corners of the property. But the really cool thing is you can see who owns it. Then you can Google them or go to the phone book or Yellow Pages or Yelp or whatever. And then you can find out who owns that property, get in contact with them, and see if you can get permission. And then once you're on there, you can see where the roads, the fields, the ponds, the creeks, the swamps, you can see all that because it's not like a cartoon map, it's a satellite map, kind of like Google Maps is. And you then, you know, you don't have to have the landowner, you know, feel like he's obligated to ride around with you for half a day to show you everything because you can look on the map. Let him look at the app. Yeah, these look about right. That way you know you're not getting on someone else's property or something like that. So that's just kind of a cool thing that I thought that we would just talk about ahead of time. Now, we're going to get into all these questions. And the first one is from, I'm just going to call you S. And I have a feeling, and I could be wrong, and if you're listening to this and you're going to recognize your question here in a minute, this is worded from somebody that does not trap or has not trapped or knows very, very little about lures or baits or anything like that. So I'm not saying that it's somebody that's like trying to dig for an anti-group or something, but that's the way it comes across. So if you've never had a question answered me on Trapping Radio before, you know, when I go through these questions, I've got copy and pasted in my computer a little note that I send back. Like this week it says, I'll get to your question in full on this week's podcast at trappingradio2.com. On this one, just because I have a feeling this could be, from the way this is written, from somebody that's not for the trappers, I have a killer season. And that's just kind of a dig if it is. And if you're a trapper and you wrote this, and then I'm being serious, have a killer season. So the question is, hello, how are raccoon lures made? Are there any animal byproducts or animal tissues used in the production? Thank you. So that's kind of a weird question. But it could be, just as simply, it could be a new trapper that's just not sure about what it is when he's buying lure and he has a question. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that whatsoever. And that, you know, it is just strange to me. You know, it's kind of like, if you are a trapper and you wrote that, you don't have the tribal language down yet. So that's the reason I'm being a little curious. about what this is. But are there animal tissues in raccoon lure? There can be. I mean, there's no doubt that some people will use a gland lure. I've got a raccoon gland lure that's got it's a fresh gland lure that has basically got glands in it. That's all it is like we would for coyotes. You could have meat, you know, like I recommend Federale's once it gets really cold for coon. That's a meat base. That's actually smoked horse meat. So you can have that in there. But for the most part, most raccoon lures and baits do not have animal products in them. They, especially the baits. Today, everybody's going to more grain type stuff and fish pellets and different things like that. You know, a lot of the baits have different fruit butters that are for bases and sweet smelling, candy smelling stuff, different things like that. So not really, you know, for the most part. A lot of lures will have some animal byproducts in them, like say maybe some fish oil if it's an old school type lure, you know, that still really works very well. It could have something like that. It could have a little bit of meat of here and there and there. But I don't know why. It just came across to me just the way it's worded. It's kind of funny. Animal byproducts. See, that's normally somebody, in my opinion anyway, when they ask a question like that, are animal tissues, that's not someone that's an outdoorsman. But I'm going to answer the question anyway. Because the bottom line is, you know, if you're a trapper, I hope that helped. Because, I mean, you know, what's in a lure or bait is about like asking, you know, what words are in the dictionary. It depends on the lure maker, where they're from, what their experience level is, how complex they have their systems inside their lures. You know, are they building odors or is it a simplistic odor, something like that. So that's 1,000 different ways that can go. But the animal byproducts and the animal tissues, if it is a question kind of like, you know, you shouldn't be doing that, let me say a little something about that. Everything in life lives because something has died. Even vegetarians. There's not a vegetarian alive that's not responsible for hundreds of thousands of animals dying. Because all the organic farm it's basically destroying the soil out in California, which is 80% of the organic, the two farms that produce that for the whole country, they've actually decimated a whole ecosystem to be able to produce that much lettuce. They've destroyed the soil, they've destroyed the ecosystem. If there's a deer, a groundhog, a rodent, a house cat, it doesn't matter. If it shows up in a farm, it's dead. There's a lot of farms that don't raise animals, but there's no farms that are on any type of production scale that's not going to get rid of every living thing that can eat the product on there. Right or wrong, that's just the truth. So, you know, and the reason that animal byproducts, when it comes inside lures, are animal tissues, you know, the bottom line for that is, you know, that's the ultimate way of recycling. You can't even grow a plant unless you're going to use pure chemicals, or you're going to feed it what it really wants, and that's blood and bones. And that's what blood meal and bone meal is. That comes from a slaughterhouse. It's blood and bones. Plants are meat eaters. Or you got to feed them something like a meth concoction with the 10-10-10. You know, that's completely unnatural, but they can survive on that as an annual. But if you're going to feed a plant, it's going to come from something that is dead. All the topsoil in the Midwest, that's because of the savanna systems. All of that was because all the thousands of animals that died and got ate and all their blood leaked into the soil. So that's just a natural part of life. And there's no reason to be ashamed of that, run from that, be shocked by that, or anything else. That's just the way it is. Now, another thing is, when we trap an animal, and we can use every single part of that for different products, that's the ultimate compliment to that animal. If we sell the fur, the chickens eat the fat off my raccoons. You want to talk about good eggs? I learned this from Red O'Hearn. When I get done skinning coon, I put them out for the chickens. They eat. They don't eat the meat, which is amazing because chickens love meat, but they will eat every bit of fat off of that coon, and those eggs are unbelievably rich. So when I catch a raccoon, I've got a product to sell. I've got a feed for my chickens. If we, because of the great intelligence of Tennessee and the way that they're afraid that anybody's ever going to make money on wildlife, we can't sell coon carcasses. If I could do that, I would. That means if I caught a coon, that's another function there that I could be feeding people along with that. It's not a good bait in other things. The glands can be used. There could be something you could do with the liver, I guess. You know, I don't eat raccoons unless I absolutely have to. It's just not my favorite thing. But what I do with that, after I get everything off of that, I let my chickens eat, I get the glands out of it, I sell the fur, I'm digging holes and putting them in my farm to build the soil, because that's what the plants like. That's what biological life is. You know, and it's just a cycle. That's what it is. Every time that we do anything in life, there's a cycle going on. So if you were asking this question kind of as someone who's uneasy about us using animal byproducts, you know, I have a feeling there's an issue with a lot of first world bubbleism going on where you don't quite understand nature very much, because death is just part of it. And it regardless if we were taking that raccoon or not, he's still going to die. And when we take a raccoon, it's way more humane than any way that's going to happen in nature. Because we're not tearing them apart as we eat them. We're not letting them starve to death when they get old. And we're not letting them just wander around when they have a disease. When it happens to us, it's one bad evening and it's over. Which is actually, it would be pretty nice if that would happen to a lot of humans. To be honest with you, think about how painful it'd watch someone that fights cancer for months on end and dwindles away. If they had the option where it could just be over in 8 hours, they'd probably take it. So actually what we're doing is not negative. You know, it's very positive. So, you know, like I said, I don't know if that question was from something like that, but I kind of have the feeling it was, and don't know. So we're going to get into some more serious questions now. This one is from Al. He said he got permission on a chicken farm with a dead pile of chickens. He said the farmer counted 17 coyotes out there. The pile is in the middle of a bald prairie that has no trees, with literally 2 miles, so snaring is out. What would be the most effective way to set up the pile with baits, back off the pile, or to circle the bait with dirt holes and flat sets help? That's an interesting thing. When you say bald, I'm assuming that you're meaning that there's not any high grass. If there's grass that's at least 2 feet tall and there's cow trails going on it, you can snare that. If you've got any type of game trails that's leading close to the bait pile, you can put in blind sets inside of that. If the farmer's going to continue to put the product out there, the chicken, like that, you're going to eventually get game trails on that you can blind set. You're always better off to figure out a way to blind set or snare, which is a blind set, going to a bait pile. Because animals get very, unless it's something they've been doing, you know, for years, when they go up to an exposed bait pile, they're very nervous. There's a lot of circling stuff going on. Now, I don't think the best thing to do is to be out with it 20, 30 yards. If you're going to go off of that in directions, from what I learned from O'Gorman, when they set a big number of traps like on a tank, and that's the focal feature because there's nothing else out there and that's the only place to get water, they wouldn't go 20 or 30 yards. They would go like 150 to 200 yards. So there wouldn't be any association with catching the coyote at the tank in his situation, and you don't want that same thing to be going on at a bait pile. You don't want that association to happen. You know, you want to get them way before that. I wouldn't really do the dirt holes. I would stick more with flat sets. I would probably, this is one of the few times I would get more heavy into the just droppings and maybe some fresh urine if you can get it out of another coyote or commercial urine. And I would set up how you think you're coming and look at the way the ground lays. If you don't have trails, I have a hard time believing it's totally flat. There's very few places in the world that's actually flat. There's going to be lower spots and there's going to be higher spots. So if there's no trails, I would concentrate on the high and the low and then see what happens there. So, and it didn't matter if it's a foot difference. Animals like to be on one or the other. They like to be high or they like to be low, unless there's a reason to be on the side. So that's where I would take that. I would look for the high and the low. I'd set very simplistic, very low-key flat sets on this. I don't think I'd be doing very many dirt holes because that's going to be food. And, you know, they already know they're going to, you know, the banquet hall or Valhalla of chicken piles out there. So that may not be the best. Now, one thing you could do, if you could talk to the farmer before he dumps his stuff out, and you've got the stomach for this, you could separate those piles into a lot of little piles. Once they get on them one time, separate them in a lot of little piles. I'm talking like 5-gallon bucket piles, you know, and spread those out all over the place and set a trap on the actual individual piles and try to catch as many as you can all at one time. Because what happens when you do something like that, that's very different than setting a pile. When you have these little piles and you catch a coyote and one's 50 yards over that way and one's 100 yards over that way, you don't get the same reaction as you do if it's one pile. Because what happens is the first coyote that's going to go in, and you don't set all of them, you want some of them to be able to do their thing, you're going to have a coyote that's going to be eaten and a coyote that's going to get caught. And when a coyote gets caught, he acts funny and he acts strange. And the other coyotes are going to start circling and they're going to act funny. The coyote's going to be making noise and he's going to be doing things. And this intensity just ratchets up. And the more that ratchets up in that type of situation over a bigger area, the more susceptible I believe that animals are to being caught because they don't think straight. You know, it's just like if you've ever been around or you've ever been in a car accident, as soon as that's over, you don't want to be filling out your taxes at that moment because your brain doesn't work. You can't hardly figure out how to put your, you know, get the keys out of the ignition or open your wallet or explain to a, I mean, you're just dazed and diffused. And with a coyote, especially if they're that way and you got young pups and old pups that are getting caught and there's all this racket going on, there's going to be a lot of fighting. You're going to have some bite marks on some coyotes. I do promise you that. That will go up and they'll bite the other coyote and trying to get him to shut up and act, you know, act normal and different things like that. So that's one way to do it. But I would get as far away from that as I can, or I would go to smaller type things. Now, if you can keep onto this property and he's still going to put chickens out in the winter, well, now it's a whole different situation we're talking about. Then once it gets cold, you know, if you've never seen a hay bale set, it's a very simple set. If it's a bald prairie, in my mind, that's kind of what I'm picturing. If it's a bald prairie and it's just kind of low and flat, you know, go get you 5 or 6 bales of straw. They'll be about $5 a piece. Dump out a half a bucket of those chickens, slap on the ground, put 3 or 4 things of hay and spread it around so it looks like a little muskrat hut. Put 2 or 3 traps around it. Watch what happens. You're going to be nailing coyotes really, really quick. They're going to see it. It's just going to look like spoilage or something fell off a truck. It's not going to be something that's going to freak them out. They're already used to that smell and that odor, and you should be able to pick them up that way. But that's what I would do anyway. I mean, that's if there's no grass, you really don't have a whole lot of a choice there what you can do. But I wouldn't be mimicking bait if I was you, you know, if it was me anyway. So we have the next question. When I do these question shows, guys, as bad as my internet can be, I always get a little nervous that it's going to go off in the middle of it. So, what's your idea on spiked urine for canine? When making spiked urine, how much glandular do you add and how much urine? And when and where is the best time to use this concoction? Now, that's a very good question. Spiked urine can be a lot of different things, and all I'm going to do is go into some of the most simplistic basic ones here, because I've got friends that sell spiked urines, and I'm not going to be saying what's in their formula. But a simple spiked urine, like you're going towards here, being glandular, that is I'm not sure I would say that spiked urine. That is more of a extender of the gland lure, if that makes sense. It can be. Now, if you come up on a female coyote or a female fox or a female bobcat, and you see that it's her time for breeding and she's swole up and she's like super ready, you know, and you know, it look kind of looks like the baboon stuff we all saw on National Geographic when we were young. Now, that is the time this could be a spiked urine, or how long, I have no idea. So, but you could cut the back end out of the female, cut that up in small pieces, put that in urine. And as far as volume goes, what I normally do is I will put 2 ounces of my booty call, which is a fresh gland lure. And this is where all this stuff gets more and more complicated, guys. A fresh gland lure and an old-timey rotted gland lure with other ingredients in there, it could be a very good lure, but it's not a gland lure. If you open up gland lure and you can't smell the animal, and it doesn't smell like the butt of the animal, but you smell all this other stuff, that's the type of, you know, when you smell that animal, that's the stuff you put in your urine. Now, you put that, the other stuff, the old rotted down stuff where they let them age for a year or two and they add this and that and the other, it could be a very good lure, but that's not something you want to spike urine with because you have no idea what the reaction is because it's probably not going to be glandy because a rotted gland with all these other ingredients is not a true gland lure. But if you're trying to extend, and that's what I think with the gland lures, that's what that really is. I'll put in 2 ounces to 16 ounces and I'll shake it up and let it sit in there at least for, you know, 5 or 6 days, kind of gets married up a little bit. And then, it'll take on that odor and then you go use it. You know, it's not something you do now to go use in October. You're going to have some bacteria type stuff. Now, another thing you can do to urine, which is, something again, you need to use really quick, is you could put a gland lure in there and then get some really fresh droppings and shove those in the bottle and to shake the snot out of it. I mean, it's a nasty mixture to say the least, but it's another way to add a little bit of detail to what you're doing. But again, you're going to have bacteria issues. So this is something you do from week to week or day to day or something like that. If you're going to add the droppings to it, they need to be fresh. If you're going to do that, you need to use it real quick because bacteria is going to do some really weird stuff with that before you know it. And you could have an adverse reaction from that. Now, spiked urine. What spiked urine really is when you add a chemical, which could be natural or synthetic, to a urine to get a reaction that mimics something that could be perceived to that animal as that something is in heat or something's ready to breed. And you know, you've got you know, the three most common things, you know, I'm not giving any secrets away here, the three most common things that people attempt to do this with, and only one of them actually works, and I'm gonna let you figure that out on your own, is high quality gum asafoetida that's been tinctured down. The other one is a lovage, which is a plant that I actually put in soups, but the oil of that is very, very expensive. Now, if you're going to try this with lovage, you need to get real lovage oil and be expecting probably to pay about $150 an ounce. Keep that in mind. Now, the other thing, you've got lovage, you've got the asafoetida, and you've got, oh man, I'm having a brain fart. See. I cannot believe I cannot think of that off the top of my head. I'll think of it probably during the show and I'll just spit it out, so keep it in mind. But there's three common ones that are used. One of them actually does what it's supposed to do. Now, they do it in very different ways. Two of them are more mythical, that are brought from herbal usage that make men overly excited and women get their attention type thing. And one of them is a little more based off of science. So you know, that's what a spiked is. Now, there's other chemicals that actually do get some really good reactions. You know, one thing that's really funny that I've seen happen, Bob Jamieson from Jamieson Lures has a matrix. And he's got chemicals in that, which is urine-based. And I've seen Newt Sterling, which if you've never been around Newt, he's a ball of fun. And he likes playing jokes on people. And he'll go at a convention, he'll get a bottle of this from Jamieson. And he'll walk around, and while you're at his booth talking to him about beaver and otter, he'll slide that out of his pocket, and he'll just squirt a little bit on the end of your shoe. Now, what happens throughout the day, unbeknownst to the poor sucker that happened to walk up to Newt when he's feeling in a good mood, is when you're at a convention and you got all these dogs walking around, they're just going to come over to you, hike their legs, and pee right on your foot. And about the third time that happens to a grown man, he starts getting pretty agitated, which is Newt's point, just to have a little bit of fun. So there are other chemicals out there that you can do that. Now, the ingredients that you use that on, as far as the volume, it's not 2 ounces, I promise you that. It's not that much. So that's just some things to think about when you're talking about spiked urine. But as far as adding gland to it, I really like that, because what it does, it allows you to take, like Buddha calls $10 for 2 ounces. You can take high quality urine, fresh is best, mix it in there, and now you've got 16 ounces of product, if you let it sit in there for about a week and shake it up, that is really, really good. But you only paid for 2 ounces of it. That's one reason I really like that. So I hope that answers your question. Go to the next one. So the moral of all that story is, if you're at a convention, you got dogs peeing on you for no reason whatsoever, you need to go talk to Newt Sterling, because I'm pretty sure he had something to do with it. Okay. This is a strange question, and the reason I'm going to do this one on the show, and this is, gentleman's name is Justin D. You're probably not the only one to ask or wonder about some of this, and this again has to do with lure and bait. I've been a trapper for around 19 years, started age 12. I'm 31. My personal best was 135 canine, which is awesome. I'm looking to take it to the next level. I put together a few different bait formulas to try this year. I'm looking for a distributor with the best prices on 1 gallon plastic jugs and smaller plastic bait jars. I'm also curious as to what common ratio some essential oils and additives would be per gallon. I understand everything is learned through trial and error, so if you don't want to give any certain ratios, I expect that. Any help may offer on offering an economical source of mixing and distribution jars would be greatly appreciated. What I would recommend, if you're looking at the gallon bait jars like you see in trapping, go to Keith Winkler at Sterling Furs. He's kind of the man on this. They're the cheapest. I can't even buy them online that way unless I buy half an 18-wheeler. So if I need those type jars, I just go straight to Keith Winkler. I don't know what they retail for, but wholesale, it's very respectable. And he has different size jars and stuff like that. And starting out, I would recommend doing that. There's no reason for you to go and starting out thinking because you want to start selling this that you need. I mean, an average box of bait jars that when you just get a box from a distributor is going to be around 140 to 190 per box, depending on the shape, size, the whatever it is that you're going to be using. I would recommend, you know, sell 50 before you worried about 100. You know, and definitely worried about selling 100 before you start thinking of 1,000. You know, because it always goes slower when you start something like this than you think it is. But keep in mind, everybody always thinks they can do more the first year, and they never realize how good they can do after year 5. So that's kind of where it is. And you don't want to get your inventory of bottles sitting there, because you're until you get to the volume. See, here's one thing to keep in mind. Until you get to the volume of, well, I may not be the best example, of where I was, say, 5 years ago, just getting it by the case and getting it from someone in the trapping industry is probably a good deal. Like when I go to get bottles for Federale's Gator Bait and Primal Pace Bait, I buy those by the pallet. And, you know, you're talking several thousand jars to get the price down to where you can afford to put lure in or bait in it. So you got to keep that in mind when you're doing that. Also keep in mind when you're figuring out your cost and what you're going to sell this for is the shipping on the jars to get them there, because they don't weigh a whole lot, but they cost a lot to ship because they're bulky. So you've got to put that in your price point when you're figuring out what you're going to sell this thing for. And if you want to go to that level of buying bottles like that, you're going to be cheaper going with Winkler at the beginning. They're not going to be as sexy and as slick looking as, you know, like when you see some of us with our bottles where they're more specialized. There's no doubt about that. But what you will have is something that you can count on without going too far in the hole as far as what you're spending in inventory, because that's also part of being a bait maker is keeping that straight. So, you know, keep that in mind when you're doing that. Now, and all you have to do is just get online. Plastic jars, plastic 1 gallon jars, spend 45 minutes to an hour Googling it. And the reason I can't give you a distributor is just because I use like four or five. Some of them have a certain bottle I want, some of them have certain lids that I want, different things like that. But you'll see when you start looking, there's a whole lot more to jars and bottles than the white, clear-looking stuff that, you know, bait normally comes in, or the white jars that you see at trapping conventions mostly. There's a lot more to that. So keep that in mind when you're doing. But just to get in there and look, see what style fits you, see what color fits you if you want a color type thing, what type of lid, make sure that it's got a liner in it, for goodness sake, before you put it in the mail. Because most of them, when you order bottles, they'll have a lid, but it won't have a liner in it. You know, but if you get it from Winkler, see, he's used to dealing with trappers. It's going to come with a liner. You know, so you don't have to be as smart. And you can figure all this out in time. But until you're selling probably, you know, 1,000, 2,000 bottles a year, keep it simple, man. Keep it real simple. And you'll be much better off with that. Now, as far as the essential oils and the additives per gallon, there again, man, that question, that is like asking me how many words are in a dictionary. My advice to anybody that wants to make lure for the first time or bait for the first time, what I'm going to tell you, you're going to have to slow down just a fuzz when you're doing this. But I'm going to tell you the best way to understand what's going on inside that bait. Number one, the base of that bait needs to be as good or better than most commercial baits that are sold on the market right now. If the base you're using does not catch coyotes by itself, you ain't ready to put nothing in a jar for resale. Now, that base, whatever that is the base. This could be meat, it could be fish, it could be some type of fruit paste, it could be all kind of different things. It could be fresh, it could be heavily tainted, slightly tainted, all the way down to rotten. I mean, so, and this is where what I'm saying, there's so many, that's such an open-ended question. Because if you take something as simple as bobcat meat, fresh bobcat meat, you would put a different amount of essential oils in it. If you put the same essential oils in the fresh as you do in the heavily tainted, you're not going to smell them. Neither's the customer, and probably neither's the animal to some point. So it depends on the stage that you're letting stuff taint, or freshness, or whatever it is, how much blood you've got in there, how much fat's in there. All that type stuff has got to be taken in consideration. So the first thing is to make sure that your base is almost a dang good, how you're treating that base is as dang good as almost most of what's on the market today. If not, you're not ready to go yet. Once you get there, that's going to take a while. That's not as simple as it seems. Well, I just use Beaver. Well, I got Bobcat, really. Well, how are you treating it? You know, I mean, and I'm not, and I don't feel comfortable going into that because, for one, that's part of my business, and two, if I say something like that on Trapping Radio, it kind of becomes the standard of what it is, and then whatever that standard is going to get overly used and abused. So it's going to be up to you. But I can tell you that most meats, there's one stage in there between super fresh and super rotten that you've got to find and you've got to be able to replicate, that's going to completely destroy the rest of the different sections of that tanning process. So you may have beaver meat that's fresh to slightly tainted, a little more tainted, a little more tainted, a little more tainted. Then you go test that and you see which one of those does better, because one of them definitely will. So it's not just the what it is, it's how you're treating it up to that point. So that's number one. The second thing is, you need to know kind of what you're going for. So if you're going to put, let's say, asafoetida, since I've already said that in the show. So let's say we're going to put asafoetida in meat. Well, one, you need to be very detailed on how you treated that base, and you need to be able to replicate it, and you need to have a certain amount of it. So if you're going to make bait or lure or whatever, if you're going to start off something and start playing around, if you're going to play with quart sizes or half-gallon or gallon or five-gallon buckets, it needs to be the same throughout this figuring this out process. Then you're going to add a small amount of asafoetida. Half of what you think you need. Not what you think you need, half of what you think you need. And then you're going to stir it up, you're going to put a lid on it, and you're not even going to open that thing for at least a week or two. Then you're going to smell it. Can you smell asafoetida? Maybe, maybe not. Is it a slight whiff? Is it completely gone? Is it overpowering? You know, and then if you can't smell it, you may add a quarter more over that half to see where that takes you to where you thought it was going to be. And eventually you're going to get the odor that you're thinking that you need for that. And when you think it's there, stop the process. We only got one thing in here now. Stop the process and go test it. If the catch goes down from the base that you found out was the best way to treat it, those two aren't very compatible for some reason or another. Now, asafoetida is a sulfide. It does some really cool things with the nervous system. There's certain products mixed with it that seems to take the power away from it for some reason. Asafoetida is a neat thing. I just got a email from a meat trapper, and I don't know how to, the link, but I'm gonna, you probably find it on YouTube, but it's called Addicted to Asafoetida. It's one of the original moonshiners talking about putting asafoetida in moonshine and drinking it. And you know, it's not something you want to listen to with your kids. He's pretty rough. It's pretty funny though. You know, that's just an extra for tonight's show. So if you look, you get bored, go look up Addicted to Asafoetida. I mean, he explains how bad it is, but he got addicted to it almost like a drug. And the reason for that is the way that it does the nervous system. So he's putting that directly into his nervous system, and he got addicted to it. But saying that, that is not the end all things you put in a bait or a lure, because they don't all max. Now, once you go out and you go, okay, I added this asafoetida to the level that I think that it should be, and it did better than it did with the base, let me see, and let's add some a little bit of Tonquin or Lovage or fish oil or some castor, and that's how you kind of get this down. But the biggest lesson I can tell you is, start with half as much as you think you need and let it sit and go back and smell it after about a week or two. I mean, a week is minimum. And then when you open that lid, don't stick your head down in a 5 gallon bucket of bait. As soon as you open the lid, step away from the bucket and smell the lid. That is a much clearer way to smell what it is. Like if you're at a trapping convention, guys, you know, unless you're just trying to gross your girlfriend out or something like that, or you're trying to, you know, show that you just love the smell of lure and bait, if you want to really know what a lure bait smells like, when you take the lid off, you don't smell the bottle, you smell the lid. For one, it's going to be cut down to the point that you can actually smell what it is. So, you know, that when I see people at a show open a bottle of something like Boss Dog and they stick their nose down in it, you've got some of the stuff that actually over time is going to evaporate somewhat. Now, that lure does not smell like it does in the bottle out on a set after about 4 hours. What it does out in the field is what it does to catch animals. Now, when you just smell that in a bottle, you're smelling something totally different. But if you flip that lid, and there's not, it doesn't have to be any on the lid. You smell the lid, you'll get a closer version of what's going to be in the field than it was if you stuck your nose in there, because it overwhelms your senses. And plus, you go from bottle to bottle to bottle, and you're sticking your nose into every one. You've got all kind of molecules stuck all in your nose hairs and everything else that you have no idea what you're smelling after you do that 5 or 6 times. So it is something to keep in mind. So the ratios are going to depend on like what your base is, how you treated it, what you want it to smell like. Are you wanting it to be super strong, or do you want it to be a back odor? Or do you want to have two odors that co-mingle together? Because there's a lot of that in really good lures that make its own type odor that you can't get with one or without one or the other. And all that just comes from the trial and error. But the ratios are going to depend on the volume and how the base is treated. The other thing that you got to take into consideration, which is very frustrating to even an experienced lure maker, is the bacteria that can get in there and destroy stuff. Because bacteria eats, that's what they do. And if you have not controlled the bacteria, it's going to be hard to get a very consistent product from things to things. And you'll find there's a certain way to treat baits in the stages of fresh to taint where it's really hard at sometimes to control those. And you want to make sure that you've got that out there. But, rock and roll with it, man. Like I said, I would go with Keith Winkler to start off with, and always go with less than you think you need in a bait or lure and smell it later. And you'll get these ratios, but you need to be able to write these down when you go back and find them. You know, I've had lure that I found when I started playing around with lure that actually was some of the best lure I've ever made. It was a mink mixture, and the base was lard. That's all I could tell. It sat in a drawer for probably 10 or 15 years, and I forgot about it. I have no idea what it was. I have no idea how to reproduce it, because I have no idea what was in it. Only thing that I can discernibly tell in there is the mink, and the base was lard, because I got it out and played with it and knew what it was. And that's why you got to have these type things that you know what's going on with them. Okay. We're going to go to our next question. Let's see, price structure. Now, I'm not going to read this whole email because it's a guy that's getting out of the military. It's Michael C. He's been going through the mandatory transition classes. If you're not from the military, you don't know what that is. But they're trying to teach him how to act like a civilian and not a raving lunatic, as he claims. He's thinking about, you know, he doesn't really want to do the suit and the tie thing, and he's into trapping, and he's already doing some trapping. And the main question here is, he's already looking at customers, and he's doing all that type of stuff, which you're rocking, man. You really are, as far as thinking it through this way. But he's asking about a price structure. And we've covered this before. The main thing with a price structure is you've got expenses that you're going to have on a job, and then you've got what you need to make on a job, whether it be by hourly, by day, by week, and you combine those two together, and that's the lowest price you can go. Are you going to work for nothing or for less than what you need? So you can keep that in mind. But what he's going to be doing is a lot of beaver. Now, most of my beaver work was for a county that I got paid a salary to do. I did some other work, and most of the time it would just be, I would just go there, look around, I'd go, if you let me start right now, I can do it for, you know, $75, $100, $125 a beaver, depending on how far away from the home. I could look, kind of guesstimate how many it was. That's the way I did it. since then, I've talked to a lot of ADC guys that do this type of stuff on a more regular basis, and they have a setup fee, which at first I thought was kind of price gouging the customer, but when I, the more I think about it, I don't think that's what it is. When you go out and you set a place up, so let's say you charge $100 a beaver. Someone's got two beaver in a pond that you've got to catch because they're chewing on some trees or something. Well, the max you can do if you charge by the beaver and there's two beaver there is $200. Now, you're going to set it, you're going to leave, you're going to go back, you're going to leave, you're going to go back. You know, after you catch one, the other one may hole up for a while. You got traps out legally, you got to go check. That can run into any type of profit that you are going to have. Now, by having a setup fee, that gives you some buffer zone there. You're already there because you're trying to pitch the person what your price is. If you can set up right then, you're going to get paid for going out there. And it gives you some wiggle room if there takes more days than you thought. And I kind of like that structure strictly for just beaver work. Now, when I do predator work, I don't do it that way because with my clientele, I've always just done it by the week, the 2 week, or a 3 2-week campaign, something like that. And I know what it costs me to be away from home, this, that, and the other. I know what I need. That's what I charge. They can take it or leave it. You know, because I'm not coming back at home at night on most of these jobs because I'm away from home. So all that's got to be taken into consideration. But if you're doing local beaver, you know, I would look at a setup fee. Depending on where you're at, the more rural it is, the cheaper it's going to be just because people won't pay it. The more big city you are or close to a big city, the higher it can be because they're kind of expecting that anyway. But I would do a setup fee. It could be anywhere from $150 to $300. You know, and the price of beaver, I don't see how you could go less than $75, but somewhere between there and $150. Now, if you're, you know, somebody like Sam out in Washington, D.C., you know, he's getting $300, $400 a beaver. Here in rural Tennessee, they'd laugh at you. But if they got a problem, they'll pay $75 or $100. So what that means is that job could generate, realistically, you know, you catch, you get a $200 setup fee and you catch three beaver at $100, that's a $500 job. Now, one thing to keep in mind, coming out of the military, and I'm sure you know this, but you're used to a salary. And what you're getting ready to be in is the opposite of a salary. And people that are on salaries their whole life, they have a tendency to look at a job from a salary point of view. And that'll get you in trouble because you'll always be unhappy with this. So don't think of it as a salary. So the way that you make really good money at this is, don't look at that as I've got a beaver job and I can make $500. What you're trying to get into is I've got four beaver jobs where I'm making $2,000 this week. Or five or six or whatever it is. Now, another structure that I really like from a friend of mine in Louisiana, which is guaranteed money, but you're going to have to probably build up your reputation a little bit to be able to pull this off. He charges $40 straight hourly from the time he leaves his driveway to the time he comes back or he leaves that and goes to another job. That allows him to realistically make about $25 an hour, which is very respectable. You know, he doesn't charge for what he catches. He doesn't charge for, you know, setup fee or anything. It's $40 straight out. That way, if he's got to go back several times because the beaver's giving him problems, he's getting paid for it. That's a very professional way to go about doing this. And I'm sure if you're getting out of the military, you know how to act professionally, you know how to talk to people, you're not going to have any trouble doing that. But either way you go is going to be fine, Mike. It really is. In the 90 days, you go full tilt boogie, I have a feeling you're going to pull it off. I mean, it really is, because of who you're making contacts with as far as your services, that's the right way to be looking at it. So, you know, keep that in mind. Also, one thing that you don't have in here on the contact people that you're looking at, and I'm not going to read these, but I would look at homeowners associations. I would also go to people that are managers of many rental complexes that have little ponds and stuff and different things like that. the homeowners association. Sometimes you can work into some type of agreement with them where they have a beaver problem, then you have them on a maintenance fee. You go out and run around, see if they have any beaver. You send them a check, you get reoccurring income. And let me tell you, from a business point of view, every time you can figure out a way to get a reoccurring income, you're better off. So just keep those other things in mind. Like, you've got the land managers, but think of the homeowner associations and the ones that do the big rental things. If you're in around town that have creeks and have beavers, you know, make sure that you go and talk to the county commissioners, let them know what you can do, because if a beaver shows up, starts eating their cherry trees or whatever, you'll be the first person they come in mind, and you can rock and roll with it that way. So good luck, man, and appreciate your service for what you were doing in the military, brother. Really do. Okay. Send. Now I'm going to find this next one, and it's pretty simple. I remember this just from the notes I've got down here. And basically what it is, he watched my lure and bait making DVD, and I talk about a real neat way to make short-term fish oil that's very high quality. And his question was, it's hot. If I put it out in the sun the way that I show in the video, will it help it make it faster? And yes, it will. It definitely will. But what you got to keep in mind with that, though, man, is the fish or whatever, whichever one of those oils we talked about that you're putting in here, that's also going to start breaking down faster. So what you're going to need to do is, if you're wanting the fresh, every day you need to go smell that bottle. And as soon as you start smelling a twinge past where you want it to be, separate them at that point. If not, it'll go from smelling really good really quick to just butthole. And that's probably not what you want to use. So, you know, yes, the sun is fine to do that. Don't leave it out in the sun once it's made. And you're going to have to check it really, really quick, because, like I said, it'll go from really good to smelling like dirty butthole in like 2 seconds. So, you know, keep that in mind when you're doing that. But you're going to like that for what you're going to be doing with it, I have no doubt. Okay, the next one. You should be right here. There you are. Okay. This is from Matthew J. I'm assuming he's from Kentucky. Want to thank you for Trapping Radio. You're more than welcome, man. I enjoy doing it. And three quick questions. You're going to be at the United Trappers of Kentucky Fall this meet? No, I'm not. You speak a lot about gang and mafia sets. In Kentucky, we have a law that traps must be 10 feet apart. Are there any other methods that a gang set that would help with a single sight? Absolutely. It's just half of a mafia set. It's not as effective, but it's going to be way more effective than just a trap in the trail. And all that means is you're going to bed the trap, you're going to blend the trap, you're going to have it where you don't know where it's at. But as you're blending this trap, right on the edge of the lever, so you want your levers going with the trail, if you're using a coil spring. And if you're using a long spring, think about where the coil spring levels are at. And that's the, you know, you want the animal to be able to walk through the jaws on that. Now, you're going to take a small stick. When you're bedding this trap in the trail, you're going to put a very small stick on one side or the other. Doesn't matter, going up or down the trail of where you're bedding that trap. You can put a small stick right where it's touching the actual lever, the coil springs that, you know, fire the trap. Right at that stick, you're going to go ahead and bed your trap, and you're going to leave it in there. Now, when you do your final sifting, you're going to reach down and pull that stick out, and you're going to see where it is. And in your other hand, or your shovel, or whatever, you're going to have a dropping. I don't care if it's cat, fox, coyote. I don't care what it is, as long as it's not like deer or rabbit, you know, where you got pellets. But something with some, I mean, if you can't find any, If you got to go to the bathroom, just aim really good where that stick was at. It's not going to make any difference. But you're going to want that dropping to be right where that stick was at, which is right on the edge. Not quite touching, but I mean like a 16th away from that lever. On one side or the other, it didn't make any difference. All that's going to do is cause that coyote, or fox, or cat, or coon, or whatever. You hardly ever see animals stepping on droppings. All that's going to do is either cause you a stutter step on the front end, which you'll probably catch him, or if he's coming where it's coming up the trail, then he's got the drop, and then the trap, he's going to step over it and get in the trap. But that lever distance seems to be the key. So, and they're all a little bit different, but you don't want to have the thing right up against the jaw. You want to give it a little bit of distance so he can step over it, and because he's not going to just barely miss it by hair or nothing. He's going to step over it. Now, that is very effective with only one trap. And since you mentioned that, I remember that when I was doing the Coyote Chaos with Matt Jones about having that law, because his traps he had to have them certain distance apart because of the law. I'm not used to seeing that. That's a bummer of a law, too. But that's what I would do. And it's just like a half a mafia set. You're just leaving out one of the traps is all you're doing. Now, I run FB1s for coons. I'm having some issues with them not wanting to set. It says if the dog does not want to catch. Also, when I squeeze the trap to set it, some of the trippers flock down, causing the dog not to set properly and will not set the trap and squeeze enough to set. I painted them last year. Scraped the paint off the spot where the tracker makes contact. Still doesn't help. Thanks again for your service to our country and our trappers. Okay, Matthew. Okay. The FB1 is a little more complicated than a regular dog proof. But once you got it tuned, dude, I mean, you're dealing with a Ferrari of a DP. So what's happening, I can guarantee you, is start with the first one. It's not wanting to stay set. If you, where you have that little latch, like the dogless part, that comes out and grabs onto that plate. If you look at that, I guarantee you it's going to be either angled where it's allowing the so see, how can I put this since we don't have a video? I've got a video of this on YouTube if you go back and find it. Let's say we got the trap in our hand and we're looking at it and the plate's up against it. And you got to have the, in your hand, middle eye now, you want to have this thing where it's perfectly straight up and down. Now, when that plate is pushed in with your hands, that's also got to be straight up and down. Now, what happens with these traps sometimes, depends on if you tuned them or not, it's coming from a factory. I mean, sometimes anything get out a little whack. If that angle from the bottom of the dog to the top of the dog where it hooks onto that plate has got an angle where it's where the bottom is coming out and the top is up against it, it's allowing the pressure of those springs to move that out of the way and fire it. So the first thing you should do, and this is what I do with my FB1s, I will set the trap and then I'll just make sure it sets. Okay. And then I will take a file. And I'm doing very little movement with the file. I'm not taking a lot off. So don't get crazy with your file now, because you'll take way too much material off. You take that off and you're going to make sure that it's perfectly straight up and down. Now that's not tuned. That's giving you a starting point. Now then you set the trap and you make sure it sets. Now once it sets, okay, you know where it is. Now, at this time, you can make a judgment call. Do I want it to be more tuned into this? And the simplest way to do this is get you a small stick and push on the trigger. If it moves a lot, you need to tune it a little bit. Or if you take a wire and put a hook on the bottom and you pull up on it, which is more than likely what's going to happen with a coon, if you pull up on that and there's a lot of pressure on there, then okay, now we're at our tuning phase. Now keep in mind, you got your little dog latch is over that plate. It's straight up down perpendicular. If you've got too much tension and the trap's not firing as quick as you want, what you're wanting to do then is start taking some of the material off where it is a little thicker at the bottom. So, you know, thinner, it's thinner at the bottom and thicker at the top. So you're going to start taking some of that material out. If it doesn't want to stay set, then you're going to want to move that word straight up and down. Now this is sounding confusing to do. It's not hard with a video. I really recommend going to my YouTube channel, man, and looking at it. Once you see it, it's really simple how to do this. But just think about the leverage. If you've got the dog going into the plate, it's going to be harder. And if it's going away from the plate, and I'm talking about the angle that's on your dog, it's going to fire quicker. Now, see, your job is to figure out how to tune the Ferrari. And I know this sounds complicated, but it's really not. Once you get the trap to set, you can take your file and move it just to the point where it doesn't set. I mean, where it almost wants to set, or you'll set it, then it fires off, you're really close. Then you'll take your file and go back the opposite direction with it, just a couple of shavings. Set it, see what happens, set it down for a minute, does it free fire? If it does, take just a little bit more off. And what you'll do is, and once you get these things tuned, when a coon puts his foot in there, push or pull, I mean, it's firing. It's so quick. There's nothing else like it that I've ever seen with a DP. But keep in mind, this is not a tank DP. You know, like the FB2 is, you know, it's a simpler design. It allows you to, you know, put the dog where you've got almost no movement on the trigger, which is unusual with that style. Quade did a great job of QSR figuring that leverage point out. But that's a tank type thing. You can abuse it. You can not clean it. You know, you treat it with a just debauchery if you want to. But on the FB1, you're dealing with a Ferrari or an old hot rod. And to get the performance, you've got to tune that thing. And it's something you'll probably have to do to maybe 10% of them every year. You know, you'll set them, test them. But once you do that, once you get that trap set up, you'll love it for that particular reason. But like I said, the very best thing I can tell you is go to Woofer Nation on YouTube, go back through the videos, and you'll see where I think I was down in Texas, and I'm showing how to tune the FB1. And once you see it, where you can see the parts and the angles that I'm filing, it'll click with you really quick, because it is a simple thing to do. It's just hard to talk in a radio show type thing. So I guess that's kind of weird to be sending you somewhere else. But, you know, I'm sitting there trying to say that, and I'm getting myself halfway confused as I'm trying to do that. So, let's see. Got time for one more. Okay, this is an interesting one. My name is, we'll say KH, I'm a beginner trapper, and I have some problems. I've tried trapping for the past 3 years, and the only thing I've caught is a possum and a cat. Can you give me any advice on how to catch more animals? I've also seen a couple of your lures that sound very promising. Mary, do you recommend these lures for beginning? These lures are gray getter and river raider. Now, Kyle, see, how can I say this? Not in a Bill Clinton kind of way, dude, but I feel your pain, because this is something that every trapper goes through when they first get started. You know, you've probably looked at some videos. You might have been to a convention. People make it sound so simple. You go out and you catch a possum and a cat, and you get discouraged. There's a lot to trapping. It's a very simple thing we do, but it's also very complex. Don't let the complexity scare you, because it is simple. But it's kind of like building a Lego house. You have a bottom layer of Legos, and you want to eventually get a house. So you build these layers up. And the layers is where the complexity comes from, but a Lego house is very simple. And when it comes to our trapping, it's very much the same way. It's it's not anything. I would say, just off the top of my head from what I'm reading here, you're probably not putting the traps where the animals are going to come in contact with them very simply. Now, it could be you're just putting them out in the woods somewhere, you know, and just thinking because you're using a lure or bait that's going to draw them in. Could be something like that. I'm not sure. It could be you're trying to catch an animal that maybe is not in your area, or it, you could just be off 10 or 15 feet maybe on where you're putting your trap to where the animal can find them. Part of that complexity is, you know, the animal needs to be able to see. Since you're talking about gray gator and river raider, probably talking about gray fox and raccoon, the simplest thing, the best advice I can give you to start catching animals is don't think about trap location this whole next year. You're not allowed to think about crossroads, fence lines, you know, drainages, draws, water, anything else. You're not allowed to think about that one more time. If you catch yourself thinking about the location, take out your a pen or a dull knife and stab yourself in the leg with it. Do not think about that anymore. The only thing that I'm giving you permission, not that I have any power over you, but the only thing I'm giving you permission to do is you only set your traps where you physically find the track of the animal that you're trying to catch. Now, if you're in a very wooded area, that's going to be hard, man, but that's just going to be part of the game for you this year if you want to really start getting this thing under control. Now, every time you find a track, take just a second and look around. Are they coming through here because it's a trail or a road or it's low grass or it's a draw? And what you're going to start doing is building the complexity of what makes good trapping locations. And then you're going to look at, well, I wonder why they're here. Are they going from a tree line to a tree line? Are they going from a river to a river? Are they following a river? Are they in the low spots? Are they in the high spots? So you're not trying to put all the pieces together yet. You're just trying to get the individual Legos for your house. But I would say, because if you put decent lure or decent bait on tracks, you're gonna catch. You know, but most of the time when people have a hard time catching, it's not the lures they're using, it's not the baits they're using, it's where they're putting the trap. I've seen guys in Texas that start trying to use footholes and they just walk off in the middle of a cactus patch and put a trap in. And, you know, they just assume that the lure is going to draw them over there. And I've seen all kind of crazy stuff that to someone that traps a lot, it just didn't make any sense. But the biggest thing is if you're trying to catch a raccoon with a river raider, you're only allowed to set the trap within 12 inches of that track. It can be a dry land set, it can be a water set, it can be whatever you want it to be. But only set your trap within 12 inches of that track. And the same thing for the gray fox. Instead of trying to figure it, you know, just assuming you know where they're going to be, when you find the track or the dropping within 12 inches of that track or that dropping, put the trap in. If you'll do that for me, Kyle, you're going to catch fur. But you're not allowed to really, don't go out and go, this is a crossroads. If you get off at a crossroads or something like that and you don't see tracks, keep me in the back of your mind. You're not allowed to set there 12 inches from a trap or a dropping. Once you do that, your brain will start putting together all these other pieces. And you may not even understand your brain's doing this, especially if you look around. Well, why would that animal be here? And then what will happen is you'll start seeing patterns. You'll start to see that, you know, it's really thick. There's a game trail going through here. It's coming to an open field, or it's going to a lake or something, you know, something like that. And then eventually you'll start recognizing that type of location because you've always found tracks there. And if you do what I'm saying, 12 inches from a trap or dropping, you're not allowed to set anywhere else. You're going to catch fur. Now, as far as lure for beginners, there's not really a difference between beginners or are, you know, been trapping 30 years are professional when it comes to lure. They either catch or they don't, or they're better than others. If gray getters for gray fox, I would say yes. To be honest with you, Blitz Coon to me is a better producer than River Raider if it's for raccoon that you're going over, so I'd get Blitz Coon, but gray getter's fine. But don't put so much faith, especially at the beginning of what it's doing, of learning how to do this, don't put so much faith in that lure bait yet. That becomes more important later than it does right at the beginning. You know, if you see a trail with tracks in it, put a lured set in, and then put a blind set in that's blended in, where you can't see where the trap's at, it's just sitting in the trail. You know, back it up with a blind set. You know, don't get very complicated type sets, especially when you're starting off. You know, a basic dirt hole with a little bit bigger hole possibly, and you tear the dirt up around it so it looks like something was really digging. That's a simple dirt hole, rock with it. With flat sets, smear it on a grass clump, or your bait or lure on a grass clump, the end of a log, underneath the beginning of a rock. Keep it very simple, just like that. But if you always do that within 12 inches of a track, brother, you're going to catch fur. I have no doubt in my mind. You know, there could be things that the trap may not look the best. It might not be bedded the best. All these other parts of this Lego house, don't worry about that right now. You will figure a lot of that stuff out later. But if you put it right where the track is, you're going to catch fur. And the goal right now for me is to get you to catch fur, whether it's with my lure or somebody else's lure. If you start catching fur, you'll start putting these pieces together because rational people just think that way. So that's what our goal is. So to get you catching fur 12 inches from a track or dropping, and you'll be good. So there you go. Now the song we're going to do on tonight's radio show is half country, half rock. And we're going to listen to it just because it's a good song and I think it's kind of funny. So there we go. And I'll talk to y'all here in 2 weeks. And if Chip wants to do a show, it's all yours, brother, for next week. All right. See y'all later. Bye.